WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
King Kong will return to the screen in December in a remake directed by Peter Jackson, who made the Lord of the Rings movies. We're going to hear about the man who made the original King Kong.
Come on, I got him! He'll be out for hours. Send to the ship for anchor chains and tools.
What are you going to do?
To build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
The character of Carl Denham, the adventurer, filmmaker, and promoter who brings King Kong to New York, bears some resemblance to the adventurer and filmmaker who created the film. C. Marion Cooper was an adventurer and documentary filmmaker who traveled through Africa and made documentaries in Persia, which is now Iran, and Siam, which is now Thailand. That work led him to the more mythical idea of King Kong. Denham is a fascinating behind-the-scenes Hollywood figure. He was also the production head of RKO, helped team Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, produced several now classic John Ford westerns, including The Searchers and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and was instrumental in the development of Cinerama. Cooper's story is told in a new biography called Living Dangerously. I spoke with the author, Mark Cotta Vaz. Would you describe the original idea for King Kong that Cooper had?
Well, the original idea for King Kong sort of evolved. The original idea was, it was almost like, if you could imagine two movie explorers getting to, or movie expedition guys sitting around and telling the ultimate tall tale. That's kind of how King Kong began. Cooper was in New York in the late 1920s and early 30s pursuing interests in commercial aviation. So that was his, he had sort of left Hollywood, but he seemed entranced with telling this story about this gorilla, and he had this friend of his, W. Douglas Burden. And Burden had made this great expedition to the Komodo Island, where the famous dragons of Komodo, so-called, exist, these huge primordial-looking creatures. And Cooper always had this fantasy that of doing a movie where he would film a live gorilla seemingly in conflict with a live Komodo dragon. But so they wanted to do this dramatic, you know, lost world idea of a lost island and these creatures battling each other. But as the idea evolved, it became much more romantic, and he started realizing, I'm not going to be able to do this with live animals.
So he decided against using like the real animals and ended up going with stop motion animation. He knew he didn't want a guy in an ape suit. Why was he so sure that that would be the wrong thing?
Well, because a guy in an ape suit looks phony. You can tell it's a guy in an ape suit, and that's the way it was done. And Cooper was always this bombastic showman, bigger and better. He wanted to bring the world through his moving pictures spectacle. And he wanted to say, how can I make this dream, this what he would call of his giant terror gorilla, how could I make something so romantic, so fantastic, so nightmarish come true? And it turned out that stop-motion animation was the best way to do that.
Now, the Empire State Building nearly didn't make it into King Kong. Why not?
Yeah, the thing about King Kong is that it was... Now, Cooper claimed he never saw the movie The Lost World, but for those that remember the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story and the movies that were made that were inspired by that book... there is this whole scenario of a beast from a lost world being brought to civilization. In the case of the Lost World movie, it's London. So there was actually this threat of a legal action, you know, because the idea is if you bring King Kong to New York, well, that's very similar to the whole scenario of the Lost World, prehistoric beast coming to civilization. So at one point, they weren't going to use the scene. And, you know, Cooper actually said, well, maybe we could go ahead and drop. We won't have a good picture, but we'll have a good enough picture. He just felt that, well, maybe we're just going to have to lose the whole New York sequence. And the whole movie of King Kong would have been set on Skull Island. But what happened is they ended up essentially buying the rights to the Lost World, you know, the copyright right to it. So by owning it, they also got the waiver, so they didn't have to credit the Lost World. Cooper always claimed the Lost World had nothing to do with King Kong, but for whatever reason, the legal guys basically squared it all away, because if they hadn't, King Kong would have ended on Skull Island, where it began.
Now, you know, there's so much like bondage imagery in King Kong. Like, for example, in the first half of the movie, you know, Fay Wray is tied up with one arm attached, you know, with each arm attached to a separate pole, and she's just like wriggling around trying to get free from those poles, wearing, you know, fairly skimpy clothing, while King Kong comes and you know, admires her and growls and so on, and you know, that's just the beginning. And I wonder if you think that Cooper knew what he was doing, if he was consciously saying, well, let's put in a little bit of bondage imagery in this, that, you know, that'll work with the audience.
Well, Cooper always claimed there was no decadent, quote unquote, rape connotation to any of this. Actually, I came across this interesting letter that the film historian and critic Richard Schickel had written to Cooper's widow, Dorothy Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, Dorothy Jordan was objecting to exactly the kind of question that you posed. And Richard Schickel was basically sent a very nice reply to her, basically saying, I'm doing it the honor of respecting it and by asking these questions, because Schickel felt that one of the reasons why a work of popular art endures is because it has a lot of unanswered questions and people can read things into it. Cooper always claimed that, you know, there was none of this bondage thing. I mean, there's the whole business where Kong starts taking her clothes off,
mm-hmm.
and smelling his fingers, and mm-hmm. those were actually cut in the ensuing theatrical re-releases. There was a number of bits of business in King Kong that were deemed, you know, too provocative or whatever, and that was one of them. So, you know, it's something that people will debate. I mean, there was this one book that came out that talked about the whole rape thing, you know, and Kong's penis, and I just always had this amazing, you know, Marion Cooper and Dorothy Jordan were pretty, they were a great couple, and they were worldly people, but they were pretty conservative, and, you know, he was a good Southern gentleman, and just the idea of people talking like that, I always had this image of Cooper just cringing, you know, because I honestly don't think that was his intent. I think it was more the idea of beauty being totally vulnerable. It's maybe less a bondage thing as it was just exposing her. He wanted to do a sacrificial ritual thing, and that's, you know, she's put out there to be sacrificed.
Cooper was such a showman. Was he involved in the actual advertising of King Kong once the movie was ready to open?
Cooper was the RKO department had a whole advertising, you know, department to dedicate. In fact, it's very funny. There are all these like in-house memos at the time where they were talking about this is going to be the greatest, you know, movie ever, and anyone that doesn't fail to live up to the expectations of the movie can consider themselves a failure. I mean, it was very much like the Carl Denham character in the movie saying they're going to have to think of a lot of new adjectives when I get back. I mean, it was this bombastic spectacle. And Cooper at that time, actually, what had happened was Cooper Selznick left RKO as head of production, and Cooper took his place because the King Kong production had been such a risk, and it was coming through. Clearly, the studio knew they had a hit on their hands. And so essentially the board of directors at RKO allowed Cooper to ascend to the height of Hollywood power and influence. I mean, he became head of the whole studio, of the production side. And so I think he was very involved in just pushing all the buttons to make sure that things were working. But at that point, he was also starting to transition to become production head in charge of all the movies the studio was going to release. And one of his decisions was, let's do a sequel to King Kong. And he rushed that into production. I mean, the sequel, Son of Kong, came out the very same year, 1933, as Kong did.
I didn't realize it was so quick.
it was almost like blinding. It's like, whoa. I mean, and that was a little bit more Cooper, more the mogul. You know, supposedly he told Selznick, or he told Schoedsack, Sojak would direct it. He basically said, here's a couple hundred thousand dollars. Go out and make this movie. Anything with Kong in the title will be a hit. And, you know, so it was a little bit more of the mogul speaking, not from the heart. I mean, Kong is from the heart, from him.
My guest is Mark Cotta-Vaz, the author of Living Dangerously, The Adventures of Marion C. Cooper. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Cotta-Vaz, and his new book, Living Dangerously, is a biography of Marion C. Cooper, who created King Kong. Cooper fought in World War I. He fought again in World War II and then became a staunch anti-communist. He supported Joe McCarthy. How did that affect the movies he made after the war?
Yeah, he was a virulent anti-communist, and he really had this, going back to being in these Moscow prison camps. He had been shot down when he was helping the Poles fight the invading Bolsheviks, and he had been captured, and he endured, like, the hell of the prison camps, and he had this great escape, and so he always claimed that he knew firsthand and experienced the early communist brainwashing capability and psychological warfare. And he always took the communists at their word that they were bent on world domination. And Cooper felt to counter that, he had to do a new type of American propaganda. So he had formed a company before the war that was reactivated after the war with John Ford, the great director, called Argosy Pictures. And all the John Wayne movies they did, the cavalry pictures that Cooper doesn't get credit. You know, John Ford directed them, but Cooper produced those. It's like the cavalry trilogy,
and that's Fort Apache. She wore a yellow ribbon.
All those movies were meant to sort of like lift up the idea of the American military corps and to kind of be an inspirational message. But his crowning thing was Cinerama. He got involved with Lowell Thomas in doing that great, you know, movie, This is Cinerama, and pioneering this whole new medium of the big screen, which ended up opening up all the big screens in America and in the world. We forget that the old movie screens used to be more like little box-shaped. The screens went wide after Cinerama. You know, but there's this great America the Beautiful scene in Cinerama where there's a plane with a Cinerama camera that flew across the country taking pictures of this great land. And, you know, it's done to the music of the Star Spangled Banner, America the Beautiful, rather. And Cooper just meant that as his love poem to America, and he just wanted to extol the virtues of this country.
Now, one thing we didn't mention, you know, as part of Cooper's storied career, one of the things he did was help put Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers together on screen. What was his role in that now famous match?
Well, Cooper basically paired them. Originally, Fred Astaire was going to be in this movie Flying to Rio with Dorothy Jordan, the woman he ended up marrying. Well, he always made this comment that, well, once I married her, essentially he wasn't going to let her dance with Fred Astaire. I mean, for this debonair, you know, dashing guy. Essentially when he married Dorothy Jordan, her movie career kind of ended until the 50s. Film buffs will probably recognize her as the woman that opens up The Searchers. She's the frontier wife that's waiting for John Wayne. But essentially she was going to be paired with Fred Astaire. And so when they got married, Cooper said, okay, well, I'm going to get someone else to dance with Fred. And then there's this woman, Ginger Rogers, and he paired them. He did a lot of stuff like that. He basically sent the memo to Selznick asking for a screen test for a certain Broadway actress named Katharine Hepburn. He had a great eye for talent, and at RKO, particularly when he became production head, he really wanted the studio to be focused on women stars. He really felt that female stars were going to be very important in the studio, and that's so. I think he had an eye for people like Ginger Rogers, and let's put them in this romantic setting with this dashing dancer, and that was one of his thinking, which is almost incongruous when you think about it, this two-fisted adventurer war hero making movies designed to appeal to, you know, women. But he was a multifaceted guy.
Mark Cotta-Vaz is the author of Living Dangerously, The Adventures of Marion C. Cooper.